Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Hello and welcome to MASHcast, the show that analyzes and celebrates, episode by episode, the greatest TV series of all time, MASH, which aired on CBS from 1972 to 1983. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, General Robert Iron Guts Kelly. And joining us this week in the VIP tent is Lieutenant Rob Riley. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Rob. I don't know if I deserve lieutenant right off the bat. I was thinking corporal in honor of my cousin from the O'Reilly, Tumba O'Reilly's. I can start there and work my way up.
Now, anyone who is nice enough to come on the show and talk MASH with me is immediately an officer, at the very least. We start you as an officer. You can rise through the ranks. So I'm very happy to have you here.
I'm so excited to be here, Rob. I discovered your show during the early days of the pandemic. And I loved it, but I also was disappointed because I've been telling people I'm the number one MASH fan, and then I realized that not only is there a greater MASH fan, but he has my same name, and I have to at least relegate myself to number two. But some of the guests may even outrank me as well.
We all can love MASH. It doesn't have to. It's not a competition. Yeah. It's all great.
It was a great thing to discover your show during that stressful time. So I really appreciate you having the show and bringing this community people together.
Well, thank you so much for listening. I appreciate it. So we're here to talk about season four, of course, episode 19, some 38th parallels. The original air date was January 20th, 1976. But of course, Rob, this is your first time on the show. So I have to ask you, how did you become a fan of MASH?
Rob, as far back as I can remember, I was a fan of MASH, and that's not an exaggeration. I recently was going through some old VHS tapes at my parents, and there was a video of me opening presents at three wearing MASH pajamas.
That's great. I didn't know they had MASH pajamas. I would have killed for those.
I wish I could find them now. So, yeah, as long as I can remember, and I think it started, with the theme song, really. I wasn't a great sleeper as a kid, and when I heard that song in my parents' room, I knew that was my cue that I could walk over into their room and Dad would let me watch an episode with him. So that's sort of where it started. My whole family are MASH fans. So that I knew I could stay up an extra half hour at 11 o'clock if MASH was on. And then I became an even bigger fan when I got my TV VCR when I was 13, which was a big deal in the early 90s when those came around. And I started to tape the shows, much like I've heard you describe, where I had index cards and I read out the plot lines. So I amassed as many as I could of the matches. And I think I maybe missed one or so now that I have the DVDs, mm-hmm. And I rewatch MASH every 2 years or so. I feel like I got to go back and revisit the 4077s. It's a place of comfort for me.
Do you remember what it was as a child that appealed to you so much? I mean, what was it about the show that really resonated with you other than getting to stay up late?
I think other people have mentioned that Hawkeye and Trapper and BJ were rebellious, but they're also rebellious and really good at their jobs, which is something that I thought, you could be both of those things. You could be smart, but you could also be rebellious, and that appealed to me. But also the comedy was just the writing in that show, and I've grown to love it even more and more. Like every time I watch an episode, I can find new lines and discover new things that they throw in there. It's not just broad strokes. It's like tiny, tiny brush strokes of comedy in every scene. And it's just something that I appreciate more and more as I grow older.
Do you have a particular favorite era? If you want to break MASH down into sort of three, maybe four big eras, do you have a particular favorite?
Well, because of the way that the syndication ran, it was hard to pick and, I didn't know anything about seasons. I didn't really know anything about TV. Every episode was jumbled, every season was jumbled in. So we have, four or so eras that I could qualify. But I know you've been talking about season four and five being the best two seasons of MASH. I would agree, except for I would include season three as well. Okay. Whenever I start a rewatch, sometimes season one and two, they haven't quite gotten to their characters yet. So I like to start at season three sometimes, and Adam's Rib, is one of my favorite episodes, so I can't not rewatch that one. So I would say three, four, and five.
All right, fair enough. Now, your fandom, you talked about me being the number one MASH fan. I've not been to the camp. You've actually been to the camp, right? I mean, yeah. you explain that, because this is amazing.
And I live in New York, and I've never been out to L.A., so I went out to L.A. to visit some friends. Around 2014, I think it was, and I absolutely knew that I had to go to the Malibu State Park and track down the MASH campsite, and it was worth it. It was you have to trek through the woods. There's trail markers along the way. It's about a mile and a half from the parking lot. But when you get to the campsite, they have some markers where like tents would have been, this tent would have been here and this tent would have been there.
Oh, really? Oh,
things
wow.
Like that. Okay. And photos of the cast, and there's a burnt out Jeep, presumably left after the fire, and a replica of the signpost. But for me, the best part was running up the chopper pad. That curvy road is still there, and you get to the top of the chopper pad, and you can see where the whole camp would have been.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's so cool.
The great thing about, the background being, the just natural background, all those hills and mountains that you recognize from the opening, they're still there. They look the same as they did, in 1972. So it's just amazing to be there and be at that spot.
That's marvelous. That's just, I would have loved to have gone to, there was a fire a couple of years ago that destroyed a lot of that, right? That's all that stuff is mostly gone, as far as I understand.
There's so many fires in California now, it's hard to keep track. But
that is true. Yeah, I would love to see that, especially to be able to stand on the chopper pad.
It's pretty amazing.
There's something remarkable about the opening credits with that, the mountains side that you see, and it's so, the curves of it are so burned into your brain that once in a while I'll see a movie and they do some outside location shooting and I'm like, oh, there's the MASH mountains. You can tell, all right, even though kind of mountain ranges kind of look like mountain ranges, I'm no topography expert, but there's something about, you can just, the angles are so defined from watching the credits that I can immediately go, oh yeah, they're standing right where the choppers would have been coming over, even though this is supposedly taking place on like an alien planet or something.
Right. Instantly recognizable.
Yeah.
I mean, to me as well.
That's really cool. Did you take photos of yourself, like in front of the signposts and stuff?
I have, photos of the signposts, photos at what was left of the mess tent, photos in front of the Jeep, and a video of me running up the chopper pad.
That is marvelous. That's great.
I hope it's still there, or if it's not, that they've rebuilt some of it, and I hope you get to go someday, Rob.
Oh, I would love it. I absolutely would love that. I would have to get footage of myself running up the chopper pad and then drop in the music and the voiceover
absolutely.
And stuff like that. Oh, that's so cool. That's great. So, well, excellent. So we're here to talk about, as I said, season 4, episode 19, some 38th parallels. As I said, it aired on January 20th, 1976. It was written by the team of John Regier and Gary Markowitz, and directed by Burt Metcalf. The 477th is busy with wounded, all from Colonel Coner's unit. Colonel Coner is willing to risk the lives of his soldiers in an attempt to retrieve the bodies of the fallen, causing even more casualties. There's also other things going on. Frank gets excited over the idea of selling the 477th garbage to local contractors. Radar helps save a patient when he alerts a busy BJ to a funny look on the patient's face. And Hawkeye suffers his first bout of impotence with Nurse Abel. Even more wounded arrive, along with their commander, the Colonel Coner, played by Kevin Hagen. Hawkeye and BJ try to talk him out of his determination to risk so many lives, but he dismisses them. Hawkeye turns to BJ for advice about his problem, then to Colonel Potter. They both give him the same advice. His nerves are so brittle from being in the 477th, no wonder this is happening. Hawkeye seems unsure. Frank starts holding garbage auctions, but Hawkeye ends up buying one of the bundles. Later, Hawkeye, BJ, and Colonel Potter are in the mess tent, where Colonel Coner arrives that he's leaving. He is indifferent to another one of his men dying the night before, rattling off his kill ratio as a defense. As Colonel Coner prepares to leave, Hawkeye instructs them all to follow him outside. A chopper flies by, dumping the bundle of garbage right onto Colonel Coner, covering him in filth. BJ and Klinger laugh, Frank is mad, and Potter, while smiling, insists he hasn't seen a thing. This letting go of the reins, as Potter puts it, invigorates Hawkeye. He searches out Nurse Abel, seemingly ready to resume their romance. Later that night, the entire camp is watching a movie, except for Radar, who can't get his mind off the fallen soldier. All right, so, Rob, some 38th parallels. I think this is a really fun episode. It is, as I've talked about other ones, kind of just a grab bag of plots. I think they try and tie it together with the title, Some 38th Parallels, and the idea that maybe these stories have some sort of connection that they're running concurrently. They really kind of don't. It really is just sort of like there's the Colonel Coner story, there's the Hawkeye being impotent story, there's the Frank with the garbage story, and then there's the Radar befriending the patient story. None of them really have much to do with each other until the very end, where the, as I mentioned, the garbage plot line and the Colonel Coner thing connect up. But, and we'll get to that. I think that's it's kind of a loose connection at best. But overall, what do you think of this episode?
I think this is a, you know, I went into it thinking it was sort of a mid-level episode, but on the rewatches, I've really grown to appreciate it even more. And regarding the 38th parallels and the intertwining stories, in the first act of the episode, a lot of the A, B, and C plots, they're laid out all either between the OR and that room after OR. And they, all this, the A, B, and C plots, you know, they're introduced in the OR, and then they move in, the characters move in out of the same space, and the plot changes, you know, the A to B to C, but we're still, as the audience, we're still in the same space. And I think that was a really interesting direction by Burt Metcalf to really draw attention. I didn't notice it the first couple of times I watched it, but it really draws attention to the title, as you mentioned, of the parallel storylines. And I guess what draws them together is, you know, war, you know, and the stress of war and the tragedy of war. But yeah, I think it's a great episode.
Yeah, that's true. I hadn't really thought about that, but you're right. Except, actually, I was about to say, except for the impotence plot, but actually that's not true because we even see Hawkeye flirt with Nurse Abel in the OR. So yeah, you're right. All four of these plot lines are going to spring out from this scene. And then we're going to follow them all. So yeah, I didn't really thought about that, but that's true. So yeah, that's a little bit more of a connection that I would have, that I'd given it credit for even up until this moment. So again, it starts out, as we said, it starts out in the OR, and there's this initial moment where BJ wheels a patient out into post-op, and they talk about that there's no free beds. Klinger has the line about, you think we're a motel, which he feels embarrassed about saying in front of Father Mulcahy. And they said they're so busy that they don't have a place to put the patient, so they have to put him in this little side room, the sort of prep room, and they don't even have enough stands for the IV. And then they finally say, well, we're going to nail it to the wall. And then they have to leave this guy off to the side with nobody kind of looking at him, because of course he's not in post-op. So you don't necessarily have like a nurse looking after him while I have to go back into surgery. And during this scene with Father Mulcahy is when BJ is talking about this Colonel Coner, is that this Colonel Coner guy is willing to risk the lives of a bunch of soldiers to go retrieve the bodies of the dead soldiers, which, you know, on paper, it seems like a nice thing to do, that you want to retrieve the bodies of the fallen, but not in the, you know, not by creating more fallen. That doesn't seem like a really great idea. So then we go back into surgery, and there's a great moment here right at the very beginning where Frank says to Colonel Potter, I want to talk to you about something. And Hawkeye jumps in and starts doing this sarcastic thing about, well, you know, when a mommy and a daddy get together and they love each other very much. And then Potter goes, put a bridle on it, Pierce. And I really liked that moment. I liked it. Again, Colonel Potter, I mean, it's in a polite way, but I liked that he's like, look, you know, for the moment, shut up. Let Burns just talk for a moment. And I like that. That's something that I think that as much as I love Hawkeye, kind of needed that once in a while. It's like, you know, just keep your trap shut. This isn't even involving you. And so that's a nice little Colonel Potter moment.
Yeah, it is a nice moment. You know, he's acting a little bit as the father figure to the camp and to Hawkeye. And even, you know, later on in the episode, we'll see he gives Frank a chance, whereas, you know, maybe it wouldn't.
Yeah.
In some other episodes.
Yeah, I think it's – now, of course, he immediately sort of regrets it, because Burns' idea is they're going to sell the 4077th garbage to the locals. And then there's even a moment where they make a, you know, they decide to, all right, we're going to have a meeting about this in my office. And Burns says, I'm looking forward to it. And, you know, he says, it'll be a pleasure, sir. And Potter's like, well, maybe for you, you know? And so it's like, he's immediately regretting allowing Burns this moment. But nevertheless, again, I think it's a nice thing that Potter occasionally has to remind the troops, hey, all right, you know, put a lid on it a little bit. Now, of course, Hawkeye gets over it very quickly because Nurse Abel hits on him pretty openly right there in the OR. It's like
trolling for surgeons.
Yeah, trolling for surgeons, bordering on unprofessional. But nevertheless, it's fine, and it's
Hawkeye's no judge on professionality in the OR.
That is true, and it's the actress playing Nurse Abel is Lynette Meddy. This is her last MASH. She did a bunch of MASH. She was mostly in the first two seasons. She managed to play four different nurses, Abel, Baker, Anderson, and Griffin. Why they couldn't just remember her name across seasons, I don't know.
I wish she could have played all of the nurses, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah, right. It's like a weird – yeah, she's like always just the same nurse. It's like she's, yeah, Nurse Kelly and too, whatever. But she hits on Hawkeye, and they head off together. Radar grabs BJ, and he mentions that he noticed a funny look on the patient's face that they had to leave in the scrub room. And BJ gives him credit. He says, you know, Radar, you may have just saved his life, which, of course, to Radar, that's a huge thing. That's a huge thing to tell somebody. And it follows up right to the very next scene in the kitchen where Radar and Klinger are talking. And Radar is beaming with pride that he has saved the life of this soldier by noticing something that probably nobody else would have because everybody else was too busy. So it's a nice moment for Radar that he's, you know, he finally feels sort of pride about something that he's done here at the unit.
Yeah, I think there's like a somewhat of a theme of pride and fall after the pride in this episode, because Hawkeye in the beginning of the OR, he's very proud of himself for doing such a successful surgery, and he says, "Who knew perfection could be so boring?" And you know, Radar is proud, as he should be proud of himself, for possibly saving that patient's life, and Frank is, you know, he really wants to make Colonel Potter proud. And coming up with ideas to do things, I think that he's really trying to impress the new colonel. So I think all of these different storylines are these characters feeling some pride, and then in each way that pride is a little in good ways and in bad ways is dashed from the characters as the episode continues on, and the more vulnerability shows up. You know, and I think that's what makes this episode special as well.
Yeah, that's a really great observation. I hadn't really thought about it. Again, I've watched this episode 1,000 times, but it's never really occurred to me before. But that's true. It's everybody is dealing with pride in their own way. And we know that certainly Hawkeye's is going to get damaged really badly soon and on.
long over – I mean, this is sort of the turnover for Hawkeye as from the Lothario. And now you see that he is – you're going to see in the next scene that he is feet of clay and he's not – not always the lover boy that we've known him to be in the first three seasons.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a great line in that. Well, it's not a great line, but it's sort of a curious line when Radar and Klinger are talking, and Klinger's telling him stories about when he was a boy and he was a baby and stuff. And he asks Radar, "Have you ever pulled kitchen duty?" And Radar says, "No, I've been lucky." And I'm like, why would Radar have to do kitchen duty? Isn't he busy enough? He's the company clerk. I mean, isn't he? Wouldn't have any of the enlisted be exempt from kitchen duty? My God, the man has enough things to do.
Yeah, he's running the whole camp, so yeah. He's excused.
Yeah, what is it like? But I mean, it doesn't like Radar says, "No, I don't have to do it." It's like, "No, I've been lucky." Well, you shouldn't even have to do it at all. You're doing everything else. And I think that was really funny that poor Radar would even be subjected to such a thing. Like, what are you talking about?
And Klinger gives Radar a hard time because he looks happy. He's like, what's wrong with you? You look happy.
And then even as he ends the line where ends the scene with you know, I saved the guy's life. Is he still in the army? Of course, some saving. You know, he's just kind of like, all right, whatever. Then in Colonel Potter's office, we have the meeting between Frank and Colonel Potter talking about selling the garbage, and you know, it's the whole notion of it is absurd, obviously. And then they talk about like bloody gauze that can be cleaned out, like, man, what are you do? You know, and like old tongue depressors, I mean, what are you gonna do with that stuff? As you said, Frank is so desperate to get Colonel Potter to like him, to sort of respect him. I love that when Colonel Potter offers him a cigar and he goes, "You want to smoke?" And he's like, "Would you like me to, sir?" And Potter's like, "Never mind." It's like like, just be who you are, Frank. Stop, you know what I mean? Like, he's just trying to impress him. So they go through this whole scene, and then Radar comes in with a report, the Trashy Substances Act, which is great. And I love that Potter's like, really? You know, they really bothered to do this? And they go through this whole thing about, you know, the different things you can use and the stretched out nurse's bras, which can be used for hammocks. They go through that, all this stuff. And I love that after enough, Potter's just like, all right, basically – you could sort of, it's like, you're going to do better to have Frank busy and keep his mind off. So go ahead and do it. Like, you know, Potter's just like, all right, just go run with it, Frank, because it's just, I can't be bothered with this. And I, you can sort of tell by the way Harry Morgan delivers the lines where he's just like, I don't even care what, you know, what this could be. And there's even the line about where he even says, you know, I won't let you down, sir. There's no way you can. You know, he just yeah, doesn't care.
That's one of my favorites. go ahead.
No, Frank has that line. It's un-American to get nothing for nothing. Like, yeah. Well, you said a mouthful there, Frank.
I mean, I think I forget where I heard this. If it was Alan Alda or someone else that said that some of the executives at Fox or at CBS Fox referred to MASH as a situation commie, because there are all these digs at you know, American patriotism and capitalism and things like that. And I think they're really hitting the nail on the head, and especially in this storyline of, you know, it's un-American to sell nothing for nothing, and you know, auctioning off the great American garbage to make a dollar. It's not so subtle, but it's really good.
Yeah, it's someone who calls themselves a situation commie. That's telling you a lot about them. Yeah. By the fact that they use it, so you're like, okay, I gotcha. So then back at the swamp, we see the after effects of Hawkeye's impotence, where he is, of course, completely humiliated and bewildered and frustrated. Luckily, Nurse Baker, or Nurse Abel here, is very sweet about it. She's very nice, and she just is like, it's okay. And she tries to comfort Hawkeye, and he's not having any of it. And then Radar comes to get him. And, of course, he sort of for once is happy to get away from this horrible damaging of his ego, because he realizes that, you know, as you mentioned, he's the Lothario. And if when you think of yourself as a Lothario, the number one thing you have to be able to do is perform on command, and not being able to do it. And, of course, probably in a grander sense, you kind of don't want the word to get around. Not that maybe Nurse Abel would do that, but nevertheless, it's like that's the last thing Hawkeye needs.
Yeah, I mean, he says to Radar, you saved me. When Radar comes and calls for me, he says, you saved me a contusion to the ego and a compound embarrassment.
Yep. So then they go and they go back to the post-op, and they look on this – check up on this patient who's not doing well. And BJ and Hawkeye, especially BJ, are unfailingly nice to Radar about this. And at one point they even talk about, you know, Hawkeye and BJ collaborate, and they talk about, you know, putting in a burr hole, and they even turn to Radar and they say, do you think that's the right thing to do, Dr. O'Reilly? And Radar is like, oh, sure, whatever you guys think. And it's really sweet of BJ especially to get Radar involved like this. It's a really kind, fatherly gesture to kind of get Radar to have this buy-in emotionally of this guy. I like that it's BJ doing it, not Hawkeye, because again, we're getting to learn about BJ. We're getting to meet this character, and it's giving us so much about him. I mean, obviously he is not that much older than Radar, so it's not, they don't have that kind of relationship, but you could see BJ has that warm paternal feelings about people. And I think it's really sweet that he does this for Radar, when obviously, you know, Radar doesn't know Radar is just sort of stumbling into this, but he's giving Radar an opportunity to kind of do something again, kind of bigger and more meaningful. And it's really nice.
Yeah. I mean, as we said, Radar runs the whole camp, but for him, he sees these doctors save lives every day. So for him to feel like he's part of that in this instance, you know, must feel so important to him. And so they really want to, the doctors really must pick up on that and want to really give him that due that he deserves.
Yeah, it's a really nice bit. And then back at the swamp, Hawkeye and BJ have initially a kind of nonsensical conversation. BJ is to talk about washing socks, he keeps washing socks, but he never wears them because they get dirty that way. And that leads to the conversation where Hawkeye says, well, what do you think of Nurse Abel? And, you know, BJ's like, well, if I wasn't married, I would start nibbling at Nurse Abel's toes until I stopped, until I got to her hairpins. And then he has that line about, so there is something there to attract a man. And BJ's like, unless the guy's been dead for a couple of years. And then they finally gets to the conversation that, you know, men can have with one another, where they can't say the thing that they need to say, but because they're both men of a certain age, they don't have to go all the way. And he says, I couldn't. and couldn't what? And then there's that pause. And the way Alan Alda's face looks so downtrodden, where he goes, the big couldn't. And immediately BJ's like, oh, that couldn't. Immediately gets it, is great. And they go back and forth. You know, Hawkeye's looking for, you know, excuses back and forth. You know, she looks a little like my mother. Maybe Oedipus ruined it for me. BJ tries to be very understanding, where he says, you know, you've been going full tilt since you got here. Your nerves are brittle enough for kindling. And then it happens to everyone, right? And then Hawkeye, ever happened to you, BJ? Never. It's like you think. I love that BJ wants to comfort Hawkeye, but he's not going to go that far. Right. Where, I mean, he can't lie. He could just lie and say, yeah, it happened to me once, but no.
Maybe they don't know each other that well yet. They're still bonding.
he's like, okay, I'm willing to help you, but I'm only willing to help you go so far, you know, which I think is – and the way that Mike Farrell delivers it, because he kind of has his head down, and he just has a kind of just a little bit of a grin, never, you know. Yeah. Like, oh, thanks, BJ. So then we go to, again, to pre-op. We see that more soldiers have come in, thanks to Colonel Koner. And here we get to meet Colonel Koner. He's played by the actor Kevin Hagen. He would actually return to MASH in season 7, playing a much different character. He had a lot of TV credits. He was on shows like Little House on the Prairie, The Dukes of Hazzard, Fantasy, Mannix, Land of the Giants. He passed away in 2005. He's completely plausible as a colonel. He's got that kind of macho, slightly John Wayne-ish kind of thing. And he refers to BJ as when he talks about the kill ratio. He's like, you know, we got the 3-to-1 kills, good buddy. You know, he's just very casual, right, about talking about dead soldiers. And even has the line about, oh, every one of our fallen boys deserves an American coffin. You know, an American coffin, as if somehow that makes the coffin better, that it's an American coffin or whatever. And BJ and Hawkeye are completely dismissive of him. They talk about, you know, we don't need you we don't want you to use us to get on the cover of Life or Death magazine, as it is. And they're, again, they're being openly disrespectful of Colonel Koner, but they get away with it because, you know, they're just disgusted with him. And also, Colonel Potter's not around. Maybe if Colonel Potter was around, they wouldn't do it, but they're willing to get up in Colonel Koner's face while he's sitting there.
Yeah, they call him the famous advance man from Forest Lawn, mm-hmm. which is the cemetery, the famous cemetery. So
yep,
it says a lot in just a few words.
Yep. And that's the act break of the episode. And then we come back to post-op, and Radar is getting to know this patient who has now woken up. He's played the character's name is Phelan. He's part of Colonel Koner's unit. He's played by the actor George O'Hanlon Jr. He still is working, this guy. His most recent credit was Battleship, that action movie from a couple of years ago. He was also on Fantasy Island. He was on Star Trek The Next Generation. He was on Tour of Duty, one of my favorite shows. And his most surprising credit, he was Peter Myers in Halloween. He is Michael Myers' dad. Wow. He's the guy in that opening scene of the movie where they pull the mask off the little boy. And, you know, he's standing there with the knife. And it's a husband and a wife, and he's the dad. Now, we don't really see Peter Myers' face in that scene, so there's no way for me to really know that that's who it was, although I'm trusting IMDb on this. And clearly, he was dubbed, because the voice of this guy that we hear in the episode of Phelan is not the voice that we hear. He only has one line in Halloween where he says, Michael? That's not the same voice, so I guess for the reason they dubbed it. But nevertheless, talk about immortality. When I was doing my research on this episode, like, George O'Hanlon Jr. has his own, like, wiki page connected to the Halloween movies because there's so much fandom around those movies.
Wow.
So, yeah, I mean, he has one line – not even a line – one word in Halloween, and yet he's probably got more of an online profile than a lot of people that were ever on MASH. So good for George O'Hanlon, yeah, Jr.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So then Potter comes look into Private Phelan, and there's another moment where they talk about some fake movies. I love chronicling the fake movies that the 477th gets, and they talk about two training films that they're going to be showing. One is called Clean as a Whistle and Buy You a Drink, Sailor. I just love both of those. The idea that these are, you know, obviously VD movies to keep to keep the troops on the straight and narrow. I absolutely love that stuff.
Yeah, those are great. There should be a separate page with just on the Fire Water Network with just all the movies of the films that MASH has watched.
I really should be keeping track of them, because it would be really funny to when this show is all over to amass a list of all of the these movies. It's just really, I just love that idea of clean as a buy a drink sailor. It's like you already know what the plot of that is. So Radar and Phelan are putting a puzzle together. Now there's a line here that makes no sense to me, because they're putting together this puzzle and Radar's got a piece of it in his hand as he's talking to Colonel Potter, and Potter, as he walks away, says, "That's an elbow." And Radar goes, "Oh yeah, you're right." And he goes to snap the piece into place, and he goes, "Wow, would you look at that? It's going to be Jane Russell." Well, what was it about an elbow that would make it reveal that it was Jane Russell? Like, don't you already know it's Jane Russell? What about the elbow is making it Jane Russell? It's not like it's her face. Like, that doesn't make any sense.
That's true. I hadn't thought of that.
like, what? Okay.
Jane Russell and her famous elbows. I think that's one of the films that showed at the 4077.
Yeah, seriously. I mean, Jane Russell was famous for a couple of things. Her elbow was not one of them. They do point out that they could have never completed the puzzle anyway, because Major Julian confiscated all the best parts.
Yeah.
What a busybody. What else did she have to do is take out the – like, she literally went through a puzzle and looked for the breast pieces and took them out because they were smutting, which is just like, what the hell? By the way, there is no Margaret in this episode. This is yet another episode does not feature Loretta Swit. So Frank conducts his first auction of the garbage, and we get – we see a bunch of the locals. And the only one who gets a line is the great – Richard Lee Sung, who of course appeared on about a dozen MASH episodes, always playing a different character. He was the one, of course, from the Dear Mildred episode with the famous 2x4, and they wanted to sell Hitler's pencil box. and of course, comedy writers can never resist the joke of the actor, the character saying something in a foreign language, and it's completely not what it's supposed to be. Frank says a word in Korean like chinyo, and he thinks he's saying prosperity, and what he really is saying is he wishes everyone in the room a prostitute.
Right, which Richard Lee Sung's character doesn't mind either way.
Yeah, work out the same. Yeah, these
and he's uncredited as well in this episode.
Yeah, that's like he gets a lot. He gets a couple lines. That doesn't make any sense. Then they talk about Frank's talking about the auctions. He says, we're going to do this once a month, twice a month when it gets warmer.
I love the jokes that almost make sense, but leaves your imagination to fill in why it's funny. All the absurdist humor that they write into MASH is really, because you could just make up your own answer as to why in the summer there's the auction will run twice a month.
I love
that. In your own punchline.
Yes, I love jokes that you have to kind of, as you just say, kind of put together yourself. Like the famous line about, other than that, how was the play, Mrs. Lincoln? Like, I love that joke because you have to piece that together yourself. So then BJ and Hawkeye show up to bet on the garbage, and BJ has a line which, as unusual as it might be, I have used throughout my life, where he says, Hawkeye says, I want to get something for my apartment. And BJ says, oh, a Chippendale orange peel would be perfect for my breakfast nook. And I have used that phrase about, oh, I would love this for my breakfast nook. I have used that throughout my life, improbable as that might be. But there's just something about saying, I mean, just hearing someone talk about their apartment or their house and referring to something as a breakfast nook is just such a weirdly bizarre, detailed little thing that I have used it just multiple times about, oh, this would go great in my breakfast nook. And it just, I don't know, it always gets a laugh.
Well, I've never been to Mill Valley. Maybe it's filled with craftsman houses with breakfast nooks.
Maybe so. There's something just so cute about nook, my breakfast nook. Frank tries to do the auction, and Hawkeye remarks he could sell brass knuckles to Gandhi. Yeah. I love that he starts the auction with $1. Do I hear $1.50, $1.75? And then he gets $1.75, and then he goes, all right, do I hear $50? He jumps right from $1.75 to $50. I don't think anybody in the Korean hillside is carrying around 50 American dollars with them.
Yeah, we never find out what the final bid is.
No, we don't. We know we don't. Well, the, well, I guess Hawkeye ends up saying, he tells BJ to bid five over. Right. And BJ, of course, is like, you're really going to buy this? And he, what are you for? Well, if I tell you now, then you won't be surprised at Christmas.
Yeah.
Great.
I love, this is what, something that I use in variations in my life, that line, just, you know, that, well, you wait till Christmas, or, you know, you'll find out at Christmas, even if it's, you know, if it makes no sense at all, it's just a great line to have handy in your back pocket.
Yes, that's true. Then we go to post-op and we see there's a little detail of Klinger's going out on a date with Nurse Kelly.
That is amazing. We need an E-plot there.
Yeah, it's cute. Who wouldn't want to ask Nurse Kelly out? She's adorable. So I like that. I like that detail. And he brings her flowers, which is very sweet. It's a nice little gesture. And it's just a little nice little thing for Klinger to do. And then we're going to lead to this very sad scene. Where we learn that Phelan has passed away, where he even Radar says, how could he be alive one moment and dead the next? And BJ says, there's not much more to it than that.
Yeah.
And they sit and they have this great conversation. And I love when, you know, Radar says, I feel like crying. And Radar and BJ's like, you know, go ahead. You know, there's no sin, Radar. And he says, well, when was the last time you felt like crying? And BJ says, what time is it? And again, it's, this is something that could have been done between Hawkeye. Hawkeye still being, of course, the main character. I mean, he had his own plot line going on, obviously. But just by allowing BJ, the new guy, to bond so heavily with Radar, it invites us to like him more because we already love Radar.
Right.
And getting to know that BJ is bonding so well with everyone – well, not everyone, not Frank, of course, but I mean, you know, he's bonding with people in the unit and he is, again, being so wonderfully paternal and sweet and allowing Radar to kind of be like, Radar, it's okay to be upset about this. This is upsetting. It's a thing to be upset about. And don't get on yourself for being upset. And it's great. And of course, this is something that Radar is not used to. He's, as you talked about, he's been running the unit. He's busy with his papers. He's not getting up into the, he's not getting up and close to the life and death of it. And he's seeing what it's like to care for someone who then passes away. And it's a marvelous, marvelous scene between Mike Farrell and Gary Berghoff.
I really love the scene. I love the way it's directed. And when it starts, you just see Radar's face. You don't even know, there's no exposition on what happened in the OR. You just see Radar's face and his reaction. And I think that's really effective. And also with the way that he and BJ are sitting and talking about death, I felt was really similar to sometimes you hear the bullet. It's sort of like a different combination of characters, but it's the same sort of scenario where, you know, death comes unexpected. And BJ, who's a doctor, has seen it before. Radar hasn't. And I think it's a really great scene between these two characters.
And that following that is a much... sillier scene where Hawkeye and Colonel Potter are playing horseshoes. And once again, these are two grown men and they are able to say things to one another without really saying it in the beginning, where Hawkeye mentions what's been going on and Potter goes, rough one, huh? And, and you know, he kind of knows what that means. And then finally, Hawkeye has to straight up said, and I'm impotent.
Right.
Potter, being very sweet, said, I had the same problem of World War One, and Hawkeye's like, you got over it? Yeah, but not until World War Two, which is not helpful. Not helpful at all. But again, it's you know, Colonel Potter is exactly the kind of guy you would want. You could go to with that problem, and he's warm, and he doesn't kind of, you know, he's not like kind of bullshitting Hawkeye. Like, he's just sort of straightforward with him. It's a really nice moment. I like that, you know, in between all that, Potter's also giving him advice about how to throw his shoes better.
Right. Which, you know, might have some parallel correlation to the other topic at hand.
A little bit, just a little bit.
But I do love this scene. This scene was cut in syndication.
That's right.
I know for sure, when I first got the DVDs, I knew I had never seen this before. And actually, a few weeks ago, I went back to my parents' house, and I still have my old VHS cassettes. And I just happened to have the VHS cassette that contained this episode as I taped it in, you know, 1990-something. And I verified that, yeah, this scene isn't there.
Yep.
But the
yep.
the one thing about this scene is that they actually say the word impotent, which is surprising given some of the prior censorship of words like you had mentioned in previous podcasts, virgin.
Virgin, yeah.
I think Alan Alda said that they couldn't show a jockstrap in one episode. And I think Ken Levine had said something about there was a script about pregnant nurses that wasn't allowed. But I guess at this point they're starting to get more successful and starting to stretch out the limits of what they can and can't do, where he actually says the word impotent. And, yeah. and instead of the conversation with BJ, Potter is actually, you know, he's not afraid to admit that it's happened to him as well.
Yeah. I think it's ridiculous that you can't say that. It's a medical condition, for Pete's sakes. It's not like Hawkeye's like, I don't have a boner. I mean, you know what I mean? He's not talking, like, it's not Porky's. I mean, he's talking about, you know, for God's sakes. But yeah, I bet you're right. I'm sure his MASH got more successful, even though the rules aren't supposed to change because you're a more successful show. We all know that they do.
Yeah.
And, you know, MASH was like one of the, like, the number one show on television, or like the number two show on television. There's no way some censor is going to tell the MASH writers they can't get that joke in.
That may be the reason for the cut in syndication, because as a young boy, I may not have entirely understood what this episode was about without that word being said.
That's true. That's right. If you don't see that scene and you're a young kid, you probably are a little like, what are they talking about exactly? Because they don't really spell it out.
I never really knew what went on in the supply tent.
Yep. Yeah.
I thought it was just kippers and crackers.
Exactly. Well, they're just spending time together. So then, back at the mess tent, Hawkeye is still very depressed. He's all hunched over. I love his body language. And Potter reads this story about the fastest amputation was done in like Hugo done in like 4.5 seconds, and the assistant lost three fingers by his master saw. And Hawkeye just goes, "I like a heavy tipper." Which leads
that's a true story, by the way.
Oh, is it really?
That's a true story. The surgeon back in the early 1800s was known as the fastest surgeon in the world, and he would complete amputations at that speed. And in this one particular instance, he amputated a leg, but he also cut the finger of his assistant, and then a bystander passed out in shock from all the blood. And all three of those people later died. So there was a 300% mortality rate for Dr. Robert Liston.
That's something even Frank Burns would find impressive.
And then there was another instance where this doctor amputated a leg in 2.5 minutes and took a testicle along with it. But apparently he was a very good surgeon, because I think back then, without anesthesia, you know, speed was of the essence. So he actually had a lower mortality rate than most surgeons at that time.
Okay. All right. Wow.
Too much information.
That is just horrifying. So speaking of horrifying, Hawkeye and BJ and Colonel Potter are joined by Colonel Koner, who is getting ready to leave. And we see how uncaring he is when BJ says Private Phelan died last night. And Koner's like, who? Phelan? Like, he could not really care less. And both Hawkeye and BJ are horrified. And he says, I remember that mission. We treated every Joe that bought it on 9/11. And then Potter gets involved and he says, how many men did you lose? And he says, insignificant. And, you know, and then Hawkeye says, how many kids in an insignificant? And, you know, they would repeat this plot line in a later episode of MASH, where you have this colonel who is indifferent to the amount of casualties that he's incurring. I'm going to argue that second bite at the apple is, I think, a little bit better done, because he just is given more time. We're given more time with this character to show how callous he is. Here, it's really just this scene that Kevin Hagen has to kind of display that he just doesn't really care about the guy. Now, he's certainly a jerk, but it just goes by very fast, right, where you're like, well, I mean, yeah, he's bad, but that could be that's the way these guys have to be. You know, if you're in command of an army unit, you maybe are a little cold. And, you know, I'm sure to Hawkeye and BJ, it's horrifying, but, you know, I've never been in combat. I never will be. And maybe this is the way Colonel Koner feels the need to be. Again, I'm not defending it, but it's just, I think when they did this plot line over, I think they did it better the second time because they just gave it a little more breathing room to explain why this guy is so bad.
Yeah, and this is back to the other plot line of this season, but they do the impotence plot line again in later seasons as well, and I think that they do it better there as you know they treat it with more care. I think later on in at that later season when they have the Swedish soldier that has the problem.
Right. So then Hawkeye leads everybody outside to, and he wants them all to see what's going on. And this chopper comes by and dumps the giant pile of garbage on Colonel Koner. And BJ has a line, beautiful, a symphony, a Tintoretto in barf. And I had to look up who that was or what that was. I never knew what a I could tell from the context when I was a kid that it meant, you know, something grand or something beautiful, except in here it was done with garbage. And I looked up that Tintoretto was a 16th century painter. And so I'm like, okay, he's talking about it as a painting. Now, it's interesting that the writers, whether this was Reggie or and Markowitz, I don't know, or someone else, chose to pick someone relatively obscure that the average person probably wouldn't know. It's not like BJ said, a Picasso in barf. You know, a Rembrandt in barf. You would know who those were. Tintoretto was a little bit, you know, a little bit of a deeper cut.
Yeah, I didn't look it up. I thought it was like a symphony or something.
Yeah,
like
right. From the context, it sounds like that. Yeah, it sounds like it would be more like a music piece, like a classical music piece. But no, he's actually a 16th century painter. Now, this scene where Koner gets the garbage dumped on him, which, by the way, I hope they got that in one take for Kevin Hagen's sake.
They did not. I've seen in the ultimate guidebook to MASH that Kevin Hagen actually says they had to do a few different tries.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. Wow. Oh, he earned his money that week.
But I think the initial tries were not real garbage, and it just didn't look good on camera, he says in the book.
Really?
But the final try, it is real garbage, and that's why it looks pretty gross in that.
Oh, it does look. Yeah, it looks like it's mud. It kind of looks like it's
lettuce and mud.
It looks like not mud, but you know what I mean.
Okay.
It looks like waste material, let's say. The only problem I have with this is that I feel that this final payoff doesn't really land in that. I don't feel like, yes, it's the coalescing of the two plot lines, actually the three plot lines, because you've got Colonel Koner, the garbage, and then this grand gesture, obviously sort of like unbridles Hawkeye,
right,
in a way. But I feel like it's not – I don't know. I just feel like it doesn't land the way it probably should, because it's like – it's not like Colonel Koner learns from this. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
There's no connection between getting garbage dumped on you and becoming a more caring human being. Again, in the later take on this storyline, that colonel would get taken off the line. You're like, okay, I see the connection there. I'm doing this thing, so they're removing me from the job. Or kind of similar to what they did in White Gold with Colonel Flagg. You know, where Colonel Flagg is going to go get people killed, so they slip him a Mickey and keep him off the line. That way it saves people's lives. But this is more kind of juvenile. It's just Hawkeye being like a wild man and dumping the garbage. But it's like, does Colonel Koner learn anything from this? Does Colonel Koner – like say, oh, geez, I shouldn't be this way. No, he probably just drives off and that's the end of it. So it's like, I feel like it's a big conclusion that doesn't totally land. I don't know. Does it work for you better?
No, not really. It's a little too short of a, it's not an answer to any of these plot lines really.
Yeah. But yeah. It's just kind of like, oh, all right. I mean, it's funny. It's a funny gag. And Colonel Potter, I love, does the whole thing about it. I didn't see any of it, but I loved it. And Klinger finds it funny. Frank, of course, is mad because that's his garbage, and Potter's like, I remember Hawkeye's like, I got a receipt. That's my garbage. When I first was going through this episode for in terms of taking notes, I couldn't help but notice there's no radar, and I thought, that's funny. Why is there no radar? I'll get to that in a moment because it feels like the kind of thing that radar would be present for. But then right at that moment, Nurse Abel walks out of the mess tent, and Hawkeye accosts her. He goes up to her and propositions her. And I have to say, Nurse Abel is quite accommodating because she's headed off to go do something else. And Hawkeye comes by and basically says, you know, hey, you know, you're kind of good to go. And they head right for the swamp. Okay.
Maybe that's why she's Nurse Abel in this episode.
maybe so. There's a meta joke there on Reggie and Markowitz's case, but I thought, wow, she just, I hope that she didn't have any duty in the post-op to perform, because she's just like, all right, okay, man, into the swamp. Poor BJ, what's he supposed to do now? He's not, he can't go into the swamp.
I think he's going to wash the socks all night.
So maybe he's going to go see a movie or something. Or probably, go to the O Club. Go to the O Club. And that's the end of the main part of the show. And then we have the button scene back in the mess tent where they're watching a movie. And BJ and Hawkeye do a little kind of little man talk. Where he's like, you know, how'd it go? I don't kiss and tell. It was great. And then Colonel, we see Potter's being accosted by Burns talking about, we're going to charge people for helicopter rides, add that to our garbage income.
And actually, I was thinking when I watched that just this last time that your guest a few episodes ago that mentioned he saw Larry Linville at a car dealership where they were getting helicopter rides. So maybe that's an idea was born.
Maybe so. Potter wants nothing to do with it. And then he hands over the helmet full of popcorn to Radar, and that's when we kind of get the slow, sad music, and we see that Radar, while he's at the movie, is not his mind is not on it. He's still shell-shocked from what's going on, and that plays into why he's not there in the previous scene. He's not there for the big joke reveal because he's in mourning, and it's a nice thing to when you see it, you don't really think about it. And then you're like, oh, wait, you know, that's kind of funny. Normally Radar would be there for that. And then you realize, oh, no, they're still kind of continuing on with his plot line, that even a full day later or however many days later this is, he's still deeply upset by it. And that's the end of the episode. And it's kind of a nice, you know, melancholy ending for what is generally a, you know, pretty silly episode. But it has a nice, you know, I liked that they were willing to end it on that note of melancholy that, yeah, Radar's going to get over this, but it's not going to be instantaneous. And so it's a nice way to end the show.
Yeah, I would say that they could have skipped the whole garbage drop and just ended the show, you know, maybe extended another scene and ended the show like this. Because I feel like this final button scene is the real resolution of all of the plot lines. And I think they do the movie theater button more than once in the history of the series. But I think this one was very effective, just finally get into the Radar's face, and Gary Berghoff does a great job communicating, just like in the prior scene where, you know, when Phelan initially dies, just the communication that Gary does with just his face is really great.
Yeah, it's really nice. I've been mentioning the writers of this episode as a team, Bredger and Markowitz. They had written some mashes before this as a team. They must have decided to split up at some point, because this is John Redger's last credit on MASH. It is not Gary Markowitz's. He would go on to write some later episodes by himself. And if you look at their careers, you see that Markowitz went on to write some more TV scripts, and Redger basically stopped. So they must have split up as a team at some point. But this is their last episode as a team. I always assumed that they were freelance writers. They were not staff writers, and they just wrote a couple of episodes, and then they were not brought back as a team. Overall, it's a pretty good show. Like I said, it is a bunch of kind of loose plot lines. Thanks to you now, Rob, I see there's more connection there than I ever thought before, which is pretty cool. I love still discovering new things even after the 95th time I've watched these episodes.
Yeah, I mean, I think it does some work for the characters, you know, subtly. And, you know, Hawkeye has taken a hit to his lover boy image. And, you know, I think for the first, maybe not the first time, but one of the first times we see BJ really get angry at the way that the war works, you know, in that final scene with the mess tent with the general, like, BJ's angry. And I don't know that we've seen BJ angry. You know, he hasn't gotten that frustrated with the war yet at this point in time. And then also for Frank, you know, there's a lot of sad little asides that he says that makes you feel for this character. You know, he really wants to impress the colonel, and when he yells at Radar, Colonel Potter says, "Don't be abusive," and he says, "That's just my nature."
Sorry, sir, it's my nature. Yeah,
just the poor. You know, there's some gives you some affection for Frank, even though there's not that much to be affectionate about. So
well,
I appreciate that.
Speaking of Frank, that's going to lead perfectly to our favorite lines from this episode. I'll let you go first. Do you have a particular favorite line or joke from the show?
Now that you say that, I have a fear that our favorite lines might be the same one. Because my favorite line, I love things that I can use in real life. And when Frank says to Colonel Potter, "How do I look?" Colonel Potter looks up at him and says, "Almost like lifelike." it's absurd, but it's just so good. So, you know, it's something if anybody ever says to you, "How do I look?" You know, almost lifelike. It's one of those things that I get a kick out of, but the other person never does. So.
Well, gee, I wonder why. yeah, Colonel Potter just cannot help himself. And this Frank, as they talk about, he's got kind of a slightly waxy look. Actually, my favorite line is from that same scene, but it's not that line.
Oh, really?
My favorite line is when they are coming into to Colonel Potter's office, and they're talking about that Frank is the garbage officer. And he's talking about selling the garbage, and he tells Colonel Potter, and he kind of chuckles a little bit at this anecdote, and he says, "The late Colonel Blake said I was the best rubbish officer we ever had," beaming with pride. And I love that Potter's response was, "The man knew talent when he saw it," which is – I know that I obsess on lines from this show about older characters. And that is like my that is always going to be my favorite thing. But there's something about, again, and I know I'm reading into it, but that's what this show is. There's something about, first of all, I love Frank's line that Colonel, you know, that he's proud of that. You know, like Colonel Blake said that to him, and he kept that in his back pocket as if like, "Oh, I'm very happy about that." But there's something in the way that Potter says, and he's kind of saying it to himself. He's not really saying it to Frank. He's sort of saying it out loud to himself. The man knew talent when he saw it. It feels like in that moment, Potter understood that Blake knew how bad Frank was. Like he's like, you know, "Oh, okay. The guy I'm replacing, he obviously knew how bad Frank was because he would say that to Frank. And Frank doesn't know that's an insult."
Yeah.
There's something about that. That just, I feel like Colonel Potter was like, "Yeah, that Colonel Blake, pretty sharp guy."
I mean, he treats Frank like a child, and you know, Frank is like a child in so many ways. So,
yeah, that's just great. Again, the MASH writers were always going to win with me when they were having one character mention a previous character. I was like, I just love establishing the history of the show.
Right.
I love that kind of stuff. This is great. So, well, Rob, I mean, this was great. Thank you so much for coming by and volunteering yourself to come in and talk MASH with me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, I appreciate it as well, Rob. Anytime you need me, I'll be here to talk MASH with you on the podcast or off.
we got 7 more seasons to go. So, you know, there's lots of opportunity. So again, thank you so much for doing this. It was great talking to you.
You too, Rob. Thank you.
All right. Of course, everybody, if you want to find back episodes of the show, go to our website, findwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show on any of the podcast catchers of your choice. We're always talking MASH over on Twitter at MASH477cast. And then finally, if you want to support the show and the Fire and Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FWPodcast, and there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So a big salute to Nicholas Prom, Russell Burbage, Stan Peel, Britt Schramm, Mike Thomas, and Michael Porter for their support of MASHcast. I really do appreciate it. So that is going to do it. We will see you next week. But until then, that is all.
Burns, some men are born to greatness. Others have garbage thrust upon them. You've got it.
I won't let you down, sir.
There's no way you can.